Welcome to KBU Radio. My name is Ed Kraus. On March 1, 2009, Portland Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, Congregation Shir Tikva, and the Bridgeport UCC co-sponsored an event, The Politics of Water in the Middle East and the Developing World. Speaking that afternoon were Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Dr. Jeff Albert, and Musa Diabat. The topics discussed included water scarcity in the Third World and the effect of water scarcity on the Arab-Israeli peace. Due to time limitations for today's broadcast, we will only air today the comments by Congressman Blumenauer on water issues globally and two of the questions for the panel from the audience. Dr. Albert was interviewed on the KBU radio show Radio Zine, and if you would like to hear his comments about water scarcity in the Middle East, we ask that you search for the name Jeff Albert on the KBU website and find the audio file, node 12532. And now we take you to the end of Rabbi Ariel Stone's introduction to Congressman Blumenauer.
The world's population is increasing. Its supply of water is decreasing. According to the World Meteorological Organization, from 1900 to 1995, global water demands grew sixfold, more than two times the rate of the world's population. Across the globe, one child dies every 15 seconds due to lack of access to safe drinking water and sanitation. Congressman Blumenauer has been a strong advocate for U.S. leadership in providing drinking water and sanitation to developing countries around the world. Please welcome our own Congressman Earl Blumenauer.
Thank you, Rabbi. And I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time this afternoon in this conversation. There are so many things in Washington, D.C. that are contentious. You may have noticed a little of that of late. People have some degree of awkwardness being able to come together and focus on things that we would think would be obvious. But I will say that one of the things that I find encouraging is a growing awareness that the water cycle that the rabbi referred to involves us all. It is something that doesn't really have an ideological, a geographic, or a partisan twist to it. And it's been one of the areas that I have been encouraged that not only are we going to be able to make a difference for dealing with water supply issues around the world that will impact people's lives, but I also think it's going to be part, ultimately, of the healing process of our political fractures, the fault lines. If we're able to sort of come together and understand this, I think it can have significant benefits for our being able to do our jobs right. The rabbi laid out the challenge. For a century, we have had a global demand for water that has increased twice as fast as population. And many of these things are increasing exponentially. In terms of things that we take for granted that we use every day that use huge amounts of fresh water, whether it is industrial products. A number of us have little devices here that have wafers and chips and whatnot, require extraordinary amounts of water. The American diet is incredibly water-intensive. Crops that we grow, animals, the range of things here that stress the water supply are really hard to fathom. We have lots of water in the planet that God created. Only 3% of it is fresh water, and increasingly that is challenged. Around the world, almost 1 billion people live without access to fresh drinking water. And the struggle, day in and day out, to provide the water for the families, it takes its toll. I remember as a child looking at those pictures in the National Geographic, and it looked kind of exotic, right? The women in Africa with the the jars on their, they're balanced on their head. But it's a symbol, really, of that struggle, because these women, in many instances, and it is usually women who are charged with the responsibility of providing the family with water, take hours a day in some cases to be able to secure that water supply, taking them out of school, and in some cases actually putting them in harm's way. Almost a billion people, despite the challenge that we issued to ourselves in Johannesburg in 2002. And when we deal with the notion of sanitation, it's more than twice that, 2.5 billion without access to sanitation. And around the world, we see the consequences for that. In Sudan, lack of fresh drinking water contributing to the tragedy and suffering. In Zimbabwe, the health of the entire country, now a region threatened by entirely preventable cholera outbreak. Indeed, as we speak here today, about half the people anywhere in the world who are sick needlessly from preventable waterborne disease. Well, we're watching this challenge being compounded by two major global trends. One, climate change, that increasingly makes it where we don't have enough water where we want it and too much where we don't want it, and unpredictable events. And at the same time, we're watching a global urbanization shift, where now for the first time in human history, half the people live in cities, and that population who live in cities is increasing dramatically. Between now and mid-century, we expect 2 to 3 billion more people, and essentially all of them will live in cities where issues of water supply and sanitation are even more difficult. Reference was made to our legislation, the Water for the Poor Act, and it was interesting at a time when there was this challenge in Congress. It was sort of the height of the Tom DeLay era. There were modest disagreements about a war in Iraq. We had just come through sort of the bizarre impeachment stuff. My Republican partner in the House was Henry Hyde, with whom we didn't have a lot in common on a lot of social and foreign policy issues, but Chairman Hyde had a passion for this issue and helped drive it through. And in the Senate, the two co-sponsors of the legislation were then Minority Leader Harry Reid and then Majority Leader Bill Frist, who joined together to co-sponsor it. So symbolically, I think this was extraordinarily important and makes me optimistic that we'll be able to build on that. But I will tell you that even though we passed the legislation that provided the framework, that said this was an essential part of our foreign policy, the first of the Millennium Challenge goals to be enacted into federal statute, we didn't get our act together in terms of actually putting the resources behind it. For all of sub-Saharan Africa, after we had made this commitment, all of sub-Saharan Africa, it was less than $10 million that the United States, the richest nation in the world, one that was in the process of investing $1 trillion in Iraq to alleviate the suffering and to be able to make a difference in that troubled area, less than $7 million, or it was about $7 million. Well, we've seen some changes that have taken place. One of the implications of the new regime in Washington, D.C., is that there's more focus. Nita Lowy, the woman who is the chair of the subcommittee for water, international, they call it Foreign Ops in the Appropriations Committee, has become quite interested in this issue. And we just passed a week ago an omnibus budget bill that contained $300 million to try and implement it. Now, I know out of what we've put $10 trillion in commitments to bail out the banks who and the wackos that drove us into the financial ditch and making our 401ks into 201ks. But I guess from my perspective, looking at really a quantum increase in this funding from less than 10 for sub-Saharan Africa, it's going to be 125 million. And I had an opportunity this week to briefly discuss this with our new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who acknowledges that this is a priority for her and something that we can do. Reference was made to legislation that Senator Durbin and I have reintroduced, the Water for the Poor Enhancement Act. Basically, we introduced it last session, and the sort of the subtitle would have been, "We really mean it. Implement the bill." But we were trying to be a little more polite, so we gave it a name and tried to reinforce it. But sadly, despite the bipartisan support, despite the urgency, despite the opportunity around the world to make a difference, and how cost-effective it would be to make friends and influence people, it was hard to do. But the new legislation has momentum. I think we're going to be able to enact it, that would establish a USAID office for water that would focus on providing safe, affordable, sustaining drinking water and sanitation in developing countries. It would establish in the State Department a coordinator of international water to make sure that we're represented in the various fora around the world, representing United States international policies and diplomatic relations with other countries, that we're going to put water on the table. And strengthening the act to enforce our commitment to achieving that development goal. We want to provide more funding techniques to be able to leverage water resource questions. One of the areas that we really have a head start here is how much is being invested already, even in the poorest countries, in dealing with water. Too often there are poor people that are paying exorbitant amounts of money in cities around the world to try and secure a small amount of safe water. So it's not that there isn't money that is being expended. And if we are more creative and match it with resources in the United States, we've got an opportunity to take the time and the money that is being expended and be able to get more out of this. Part of what I find encouraging over the course of just 7 years, but watching the change that has taken place. Because there are Girl Scout troops and Rotary clubs, churches and synagogues around the country who've taken this issue on. It doesn't require a great deal of technological skill or a great deal of money. People can go to a village in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, and they can make a difference for hundreds of people in a matter of hours. Watching the breadth of involvement is something that I find to be extraordinarily heartening. It's also the notion that kind of we're in this together, because in the United States, we're exhibiting some of the signs of water stress. If you followed what's going on in California with the persistent drought, we've had one in southeastern United States. There are challenges between Native Americans and farmers and people who care about fish and wildlife, where these conflicts are being visited upon us. And many of the same techniques and technologies are going to make a difference in our country as around the world. I am hopeful that we can spend a little time this afternoon. I look forward to some of the real experts that will be discussing this with you, and that we can remember what the rabbi said, because we'll spend hour and a half in conversation. We will have access to safe drinking water right here that you can get out of the tap for free. We've got goofy people who buy designer water at $30 a gallon. And in fact, I've been thinking about a little surcharge on some of the bottled water to fund some of the international resource to try and boost that up, a certain symmetry there. But in the course of the conversation, we will see about 360 children who will lose their lives because of a lack of access to what we take for granted. So I appreciate your dedicating time on your Sunday afternoon for this conversation and look forward to where it takes us. Thank you very much.
And now a few questions from the audience.
Hi, Congressman Blumenauer. I'm concerned about water privatization.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, Karen Mitzner. I'm concerned about water privatization globally, and I wanted to get your thoughts about what water privatization has done in countries, you know, like Brazil, Argentina, that is damaging, and whether that's a part of your thinking as you move forward with legislative efforts to solve world water supply.
The notion that water resources would be privatized by large international companies is quite controversial. It has, as you mentioned, there have been instances where it has been. There are two conflicting notions here. One, the good Lord gives us water for free, but as has been pointed out, he very seldom provides purification and pipes to be able to move it. So there is often in urban settings investments. What we found is that a number of those situations have been failures. It has not particularly been successful, either for the indigenous population or, frankly, for the companies. And we're seeing that what 15, 20 years ago looked to be a wave, and there may be more specific that our friends could speak to, but from my vantage point, it seems to me that there's less pressure in that direction. The work that we've been doing has been focused more in terms of having the United States provide assistance for setting systems in place. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm extraordinarily interested and enthusiastic about efforts that people have undertaken on a more person-to-person basis. Water resources, in my judgment, should appropriately be administered by municipalities and government agencies. There are appropriate roles for private sector firms in terms of helping manage those resources, constructing the facilities. But I think we're seeing a retreat from an effort at global privatization. We're seeing there's been political backlash, and it hasn't been that effective for them financially. And
I guess the only thing that I would add is there are two things. One is privatization can take many forms. It can be a short-term, very narrow contract to operate a portion of a system, and it can be the wholesale sale of a system, and those represent very different things. So I think we have to understand that that privatization is not kind of a homogeneous policy. The other thing is, at least in the developing world, we have to recognize that that municipalities and governments are hugely undercapitalized, and there are enormous. I mean, it's going to cost us tens of billions of dollars a year to maintain water systems in the United States, and think of what the costs are to construct non-existent systems in places like India, Bangladesh, throughout sub-Saharan Africa. So the private sector may have roles to play, but you know the key thing is the concern over control, right? Over taxing the rain. That was what led to violence in Bolivia, for example. But I think it's very important to not become too dogmatic about these things. There are also examples, in particular, Representative Blumenauer mentions this person-to-person interaction, but small systems, small community systems. Are increasingly managed by by small businesses in places like India. I just came back from Rwanda, where there's not the same scale of privatization, but much smaller scale privatization that's quite successful, and without any objection by civil society. So,
I think the issue, and it's one we have to learn here in the United States, as we're looking at schemes for privatization of roadways and people wanting to sell city halls and everything else, it's important to have the appropriate framework for control and accountability. I am hopeful that we get more sophisticated. There have been some bad deals that have been executed in the United States, in my judgment, for privatization. And I think the appropriate vision is one of a regulated utility, where the government agency, whether it's in the United States or someplace else, has a legal framework, where there is a contract, where there are mechanisms for holding people accountable, for making adjustments over time, for making it transparent, for making sure that there aren't exorbitant extractive fees and charges. But as I say, looking at the way that Indiana just sold the Indiana Tollway, I'm not certain that we're that sophisticated with some of those in the United States.
I'm a recent transplant from California. My house is still there, and I'm renting here. And this isn't directly on the Palestinian issue, but I just wanted to say that, you know, there's 1 million acres I read that aren't going to be farmed now in California. And this is a really serious crisis because California is a food basket for our state and the world. And I didn't see anything about, you know, water and resolving California's problems, which are similar to the problems that we're talking about right here. Water is a regional thing. Yeah. And then this new stimulus bill that was put forward, I didn't see any discussion of water as an infrastructure project. So I'm raising this to you personally. I'm in Portland now, and I'm going to buy a home, so I'm going to become a Portlander, and you're the representative. But maybe if people first understood the importance of water and what we're going to do about it in this country, then it could be related to Palestine. But it's not even been discussed. The whole thing has been hushed up. 1 million acres unplanted now. 80,000 people out of work because of this. And it just sat there quietly, and no one talked about it because of the budget problem. So that's all I wanted to say.
Actually, if you look at the stimulus bill, you'll see that there are billions of dollars there for water resources. In fact, we've got projects here in Oregon, tens of millions of dollars, that will be to help improve the quality of the Willamette River, and people will be at work on that in a matter of months. There are a range of things we need. And part of what's goofy about California, with all due respect, is subsidizing farmers to grow rice in the desert. Or if you go from Yuma to Phoenix, and you look on either side of Highway 10, and there is subsidized cotton that is being grown in the desert there. We're talking about a massive tunnel project from Lake Mead to Las Vegas, where there is an unsustainable pattern that where we had, until the housing crisis exploded on them, we had the most rapidly growing city in the United States, replete with golf courses in the desert and bizarre landscaping. It's a reality check in California, in Oregon, in Phoenix, around the country, where we just simply cannot continue to practice non-sustainable applications of water. The largest irrigated crop in the United States is?
Grass.
Millions of acres of nice green lawn that is a pain in the neck to maintain, but contributes to all sorts of problems. In many parts of the United States, it's extraordinarily thirsty, and the notion of pesticide and fertilizer runoff, well, we've got problems in rural America, but I will tell you that we have serious problems across the United States with runoff from what people put on their backyards. So there is a a mindset that we're going to have to adjust on a whole range of areas. Part of it's personal. If we're going to have lawns here, they're going to get brown in the summer. So be it. We are going to pay more for water. We have wildly differing systems in the United States for who pays what for water. There are some parts of the country where they get water that, a heavily subsidized water for agriculture at the expense of Native American interests and wildlife. If we had modest pricing, if we had reasonable regulations, if we'd stop subsidizing stupid stuff in our agricultural policy, we could make substantial improvements. We haven't talked about mining fossilized water from aquifers. It's a horrible problem in terms of drawing up so much more water than nature can recharge. The Dust Bowl was not somehow an isolated act of God. It was people moving into areas, disrupting an ecosystem that existed for millennia, and then mistaking short-term hydrological and climate conditions for what could be sustained over time. You're touching on something that has many facets. We are slowly doing a better job at the federal level, but the things like the Colorado River dramatically oversubscribed, non-sustainable practices in terms of urban living as well as what happens in farmlands. We missed, I'll get off my high horse. Lucky for you, I have to be out of here. I'm already late, but because you pushed a button and dropped a nickel in. But one of the things that just so irritated me in the last farm bill, we are spending billions of dollars, most of which goes to six states to grow a dozen crops, most of which the world doesn't need any more of, and things like the subsidization of sugar, rice, cotton in areas that are inappropriate. Corn, we've got the goofy policy of corn ethanol, which doesn't appear to create much more energy than it takes to go into it.
And it's causing food riots in Mexico.
Disrupting what's happened in south of the border and creating a dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River that's about the size of Delaware now and growing. So getting our policies right, paying farmers not to grow more of what we don't need, but pay them for water quality and water quantity would make a huge difference in California, would make a huge difference in the Southwest, would make a difference here in Oregon, and get us back on a sustainable path.
Thank you for listening to The Politics of Water in the Middle East and the Developing World, recorded Sunday, March 1st, 2009. For KABU Radio, this is Ed Krause.